Hello and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. You may notice a little bit of background noise going on here. This is Scott Keith. I've said in last several episodes, we are in the middle of our summer. And when it's summer at 1517, everybody travels. So it's very difficult to get Rod and Adam and I in the same place during the months of June, July, and August. And so I've been going on some solo trips. Today I am at the NALC Convocation. Is that what?
Yep.
NALC Convocation, North American Lutheran Church Convocation. In where am I? I am in Nashville, Tennessee. We are in a bar. And last year when we were at the NALC Convocation, we sat down with, I'd like to say that he's a friend, but to me he's really more than a friend. I struggle for a category other than a dad to me, Jim Nestigan. Hi, Jim.
Nice to see you.
It's good to see you as always.
I'm glad to sit in with you anytime.
I love it. We also, I needed a guest host to come on with me today, so I grabbed my friend and former student, Kevin McLean, who's now a pastor.
Indeed.
In
Indeed.
Brethren, Michigan. What's the name of your church?
It's actually Manistee, Michigan. It's Good Shepherd Evangelical Lutheran Church in Manistee, Michigan.
You should check it out. I hear this guy preaches like a... Like gymnastics.
Like a preacher, like baby. A preacher. I learned from some good people around this table.
That's
so
great.
So Kevin's sitting in as a co-host. He's going to help me along with this. And it's pretty fun when you have Jim Nestigan as a guest because you can kind of just, as a host, sit back and listen to the good stories.
Let him wander.
And let him wander. I just sat in on your little session there on Philippians 2. And, you know, anytime I think I'm getting good at this this little game we're in, I sit back and listen to you, and I think I've got about 30 years worth of learning yet to do.
Well, flattery will get you everywhere.
I know. That's why I'm doing it. You know, you get to a point where you think you're decent at telling a story, and then you sit down and listen to Jim tell a story, and you're like, crap.
It's, you know, we're taught to proclaim the gospel boldly, and I know I have a little too much fear still in me in these early years of my ministry, because I will not make a reference to the two bulls joke that I heard you reference earlier today.
Right.
That is courage, my friend. That's some good
stuff. One of my best friends ever is here.
Yeah.
He represents the best of Southern Lutheranism. There was a famous group here called the Tennessee Synod, the North Carolina Synod in those days, early to mid 19th century, had gone to hell. It had gone over to, you know, progressive liberalism. It was just deader than a doornail. And there was a group that rose up against it called the Tennessee Synod. And one among the leaders was David Henkel, who was a translator of the Book of Concord from over in Newmarket, Virginia. And there is an absolutely fabulous tradition that comes out of those guys Carolina, in the Carolinas and in the eastern part of Tennessee. And some of those guys were in the audience today, one of the best of them. And to me, they are men of faith who have kept the faith in the face of the onslaught. And so it was absolutely thrilling for me to be here and see those guys again. I mean, it's, one of them is getting up. It's hard for him to walk, and he got up to receive the sacrament, and it took him about 15 minutes to get up there and back. And he's struggling with himself, but boy, the minute he hears the word, it's just like a light goes on, you know. You just have to love them.
It's a gift to keep company with men like that.
Well, to me, those guys have been they've been the ones that have sustained me through all of this mess over the last several years. And I saw Larry today, and I just wept for joy. There he is. He can hardly drag his body around, and he's up there confessing right in front of everybody.
It's beautiful.
Oh, it's just fabulous.
So, Jim, a couple weeks ago I gave you a call and I said, hey, I'm going to be in Nashville with you. Can we do a podcast? And you said, sure.
You bet.
I said, hey, I'd like to follow in this line. We've been doing episodes on different heroes of the Christian faith, and we've done now two episodes on Luther. We did sort of early Luther, We did mid-career Luther. We had Donovan Riley help us out with the mid-career.
Oh, sure.
He took your name in vain a couple of times and told some stories about you that, you know, I don't know. But I thought, I called you and said, hey, would you like to do Luther in his late career? And you said, yeah, I can do old man Luther. I can relate to that.
Yep.
So let's do some old man Luther.
Sure.
So Luther is born, what, 1483?
83, yep.
Dies in 1546.
Right.
So he's younger than you at that point when he dies.
Well, really the story is that in 1528 he had a heart attack.
Yeah.
That he barely survived. And so...
so he's a young man in 1528 having a heart attack.
Right. But he used himself horribly.
Right.
I mean, he didn't pay any attention, and he... I mean, even after he married, he was inclined to work. He would disappear into his office for 3-4 days at a time, and he would work continuously through that time without food or rest.
Jeez.
And he would, you know, he would produce copiously, abundantly,
right,
more than you could imagine.
Right.
And then he'd collapse and fall asleep, and he'd wake up again and go again. And though Catherine von Bora was, you know, more than his match, she couldn't control that.
Sure.
He didn't have any control over it either.
Right.
And so, especially in the early 30s, he's having big trouble with himself. He had vertigo, so he was quite afraid of fainting.
Oh, wow.
And he suffered from tinnitus, so he had a continual ringing in his ears.
Oh, I know about that. I've suffered from tinnitus since I was 26.
Oh, you know what it is?
Yeah.
It just
lack of sleep, constant distraction, unless there's something going on.
Drove him to distraction.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't know what to do with it. And there was really no diagnosis available other than, you know, you got ringing in your ears.
Right.
Which you knew already.
Yep.
And didn't need to be told.
It's funny. It's not much different today, to
be
honest with you. I mean, they tell you have tinnitus, and it's like you
good luck.
You have tinnitus.
Yeah.
You know, so.
This is the world's most vaunted medical profession,
yeah,
you know, that charges you $1 million for the pills and tells you to go home and take a nap.
That's right. Yeah.
Big deal. Like Bill Lazarus used to say, I don't know what the medical profession is so impressed about. We all die anyway. Perfect.
I've heard that's why they call it a practice.
Yeah. That's exact.
Always failing in the big game.
Make you sick. Well, they're right there with their charges, you know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he was, he suffered a lot of depression during this time. He was given to depression, and he there was really reason for it in his health and in the Reformation. So he didn't need any encouragement to despair, and he did.
I think too, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think we underestimate the pressure these guys were under. I mean, I think we hold them up as heroes of the faith, and we say, isn't this great things that they've done? But for Luther, I mean, by 1521, he's basically cast out of his life, right? He's a monk, a priest, and a professor in the Roman Catholic Church. And by 1521, they say, you can't be any of these things anymore. And from that point on, you know, another 25 years of just trying to figure out even what to do.
Yeah.
I don't think they had the sense of themselves that we have of them, that they knew what was going on, and they had confidence in the next day's meal and all of that stuff.
No, he was an outlaw.
Right.
In every sense of the term. And everything about his life was irregular. After 1521, you know, when the thesis exploded, when he came to the point where he knew that, I suppose I used some colorful language earlier. He said about himself, "I am a ripe stool in the bunghole of the world. We will soon be parted."
Right, that's right.
Absolutely. That's exactly what he was. I mean, he was just, you know, being expelled.
Right, and for the listeners, just keep it in perspective. We're in 2017 now. We're celebrating the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Right. And why we call it 500 years is because in 1517, Martin Luther nails the 95 Theses to the door of the castle church in Wittenberg. But really, I mean, between 1517 and 1521, Luther is writing a lot, including his famous three treatises, Heidelberg Disputations. And he gets himself into some trouble between that period.
Right.
And that's why he's called in 1521 to the Diet at Worms.
Right.
But at the time he starts doing this in 1517, he's doing pretty well, right? He's got things all figured out as far as his normal life would go.
Yep.
And when things start to go downhill in 1521, I'm sure that had to be a shock to the system.
Yeah. Well, you know, he, in addition to all of that, you know, he had to deal with the radical reformers who were friends of his and who betrayed him.
Right.
You know, so... So if it hadn't have been for his 12 sermons, the Inquivocabit sermons, he would have lost the whole thing. I mean, so he's keeping up with it, but he's living in an emergency situation constantly.
Constantly.
And it's wearing on him.
Right.
It's heavy. So when he marries in 1525, he says he marries to make the angels laugh and the devils weep. And he, you know, rejoices in Catherine Bunbury's pigtails on his pillow and writes to his friends about the joy of penetrating her. I mean, that's about as graphic as you would like to get. But she's bringing some stability and... Of course, she's pregnant nearly all the time.
Right.
You know.
Six children.
So it's, when the kids are filling up the house and he's trying to come to terms with things. And then he has that heart attack in 1528 and more heart trouble in 1531. So it's just extraordinary.
Right.
I mean, if you measure his achievement against the pressure that he was under, it's just extraordinary.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can hardly imagine living like that. So he preached, you know, something over 4,000, 5,000 times. But in 1531, 32, 33, there are 15, 16 sermons in some years. He gets into the pulpit and the tinnitus takes over or the vertigo and he's just having a battle.
Right.
So he's a different man after this.
Right. And we even like to say that he got past his Anfechtungen, you know, at the point of his evangelical discovery. But he still fights that. He still fights this sense
Absolutely.
Of despair and
Absolutely.
Looming doom.
Yep.
You know, And maybe it goes from, you know, he's no longer fighting this despair over assurance of his salvation, but his earthly life, even when he's prosperous, he knows can be taken away at any minute.
Exactly. No, that's the reality of his life is a continual testing where he can't take anything for granted.
Right.
So, you know, I had a good friend who died some years ago, Douglas John Hall, who was at Montreal, and he talked about Luther's extraordinary sensitivity. But if you look at what produced that sensitivity, I mean, it's not surprising.
Right.
I mean, when you live at that level of angst, just...
All the time.
All the time. You know, it produces a kind of... You either come to faith or you die.
Right, right.
One or the other.
Yeah.
Being in a parish, you're working every day just in the life of the parish.
Oh, yeah.
People are dying. People are getting married. They're having kids. You're baptizing children.
Yep.
You're trying to be a husband and a father. There's so much that goes into that. And if you add into that situation the fear of death that we generally don't experience here in the United States,
right.
that our brothers and sisters in Africa do, the kind of pressure that's on someone. You see, even like the Sermon of the Castle Pleissenberg at the eve of the Reformation.
Sure.
It ends not because he's done preaching. It ends because he's physically incapable of proceeding.
Carrying on, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, that's, you know, when you know the kind of trouble he was in, that's not surprising. But what is surprising is that he and Catherine von Bora maintained a kind of a level of public function, you know, that was, I mean, that was just astonishing. I mean, you know, they're running a hotel, they're running a dormitory, they're running a chapel, they've got classrooms in the house.
Right.
An infirmary during the plague?
Exact. It just never stops. And both of them are the kind of people that you load them up and they carry.
Right.
And that's the story of the last years of his life. He did some magnificently stupid things. I mean, you know, if you look at his writings on the Jews and his actual relations with the Jewish community, you can see where they come from, where the anti-Jewish writings come from. But you know, even still, they're excessive in a degree that's inappropriate and, you know, indefensible. Finally, in the end. They're more understandable, they're more historical, there's more reality to them. But even still, you know, you have to say, well, why did he say that? I mean, why didn't he just shut up?
Yeah, I mean, putting things in context doesn't excuse guilt. Really.
No, it doesn't excuse it at all.
Yeah.
No, it is... It is for a pastor, I think, to experience frustration. You know, you throw your heart and your life into this, and especially for Luther in a way that, you know, most of us will never experience. But to reach the end and to know that you're getting close to that end and to feel that there have been ways where I failed.
Yeah, for that's somebody. Tough. That's tough. Yeah. That's just tough. At the same time, some of the very best stuff he wrote comes from the later period. I mean, that's just penetratingly insightful. For instance, the Antinomian Disputations, 1536 to 39, I mean, are a kind of a tour de force of a theological argument. It's just a magnificent, a powerful explication of the doctrine of law.
That's something that we... in modern Lutheran disputation, I think, would do well to read and to revisit.
Oh, yeah. You can't. Now there's a translation available, and it's pretty good. You know, the Decalogue is eternal. I mean, that's kind of an unfortunately polemical claim, but it's fun. It's a good translation.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, there's... if you read the Genesis commentary, 8 volumes. I mean, yeah, I spent a whole year and I read the whole blame thing from start to finish. And it is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the last parts of it are written very late in his life, 1545, you know, 44, 45 into 46, and he died in February 46. I mean, he's, you know, but still some of the finest stuff on repentance that you can find, where he's just measuring it right down to the millimeter. You know, it's just fabulous. So there's great stuff, but there's dumb stuff. And it's much more mixed in his later life. I mean, he's you know, he was always irascible and hard to predict and, you know, kind of a jerk in lots of ways, but he, you know, even in these late years, there's stuff in there that you just, I remember when I was reading the commentary on Genesis, I spent a whole year reading it, and I remember looking up the Latin text late on, and I knew how sick he was, and I knew how death-ridden he was, and I knew the whole thing, and I just, when I read it, I just wept for joy. I mean, there it is, the gospel's working, it's driving, it's still got its power in him. I mean, that's just astonishing.
I'm glad you brought up the antinomian writings, because that's one of the things that I actually think about when I think of his later life, because to me, this is a persistent thorn in the heel of the Lutheran Reformation. One, the teaching on antinomianism, and two, the charge of antinomianism. And I mean, this goes back to 1525, and you can almost describe this to the early Luther, early Lutheranism, early Lutheran Reformation, with Johannes Agricola and Melanchthon really kind of getting into it. And Luther's antinomian writings start 1536,
right?
Which is, it makes a lot of sense, because in 1535, Melanchthon, of course, in the Loci Communis, first describes this third use of the law in response to the antinomians of his time. Did it ever just weigh on Luther, sort of being that final weigh-in judge? I mean, it would weigh on me. It's like this antinomian dispute persists for, I mean, it persists to this day, but it persists in the Reformation from 1525 on through the Formula of Concord.
Right.
And that type of, I would guess that type of thing just got, I would get sick of it. I mean, it'd be enough.
You know?
If he starts writing in 1536, we're talking 10 years later, he's still trying to sort of arbitrate this dispute.
Well, Scott, I mean, we've been together on this argument a long time. I still think that Luther suspected Melanchthon of nomism.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Of legalism. And he's trying to find a way, you know, between Melanchthon's emerging legalism and Agricola's, you know, B-squad antinomianism.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, I mean, there's not, Agricola was not, I mean, he was not troubled with excessive finesse.
No. And perhaps Melanchthon was troubled with excessive finesse.
Oh, that's exactly the truth. I mean, Melanchthon was like, you know, one of your very best students taking a true-false test.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but
possibly
no. Yeah, no, but possibly yes. Yep. I mean, he can see the, he can finesse it, and it's driving him crazy, whereas, you know, Agricola is...
exhorting.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it just makes you kind of sick, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I love his wife, Elsa. She was just a fabulous woman. And, I mean, she bore him 13 children, you know.
Oh, my.
He wouldn't leave her alone.
Yeah, I guess not, yeah.
He's out there yelling about the end of the law, and he's on the end of Elsa every chance he gets. I mean, it makes you kind of... But, you know, Luther loved her too. I mean, she was really sharp. She had a good intelligence, and she had a great, you know, theological sense.
Right.
But Johann was...
perhaps less so.
I remember one time, I'll tell you this just for the fun of it. In the old days, I used to get invited down to Concordia, St. Louis to give lectures. And it was old Jack Price, you know, who was a Norwegian nationalist to the very end. I mean, he was misplaced in the Missouri Synod. He still loved the Norwegian theologians, and he still loved the Norwegian heritage. And so he'd bring me down there just to make trouble for him, you know.
Oh, that's good. And the great translator of Chemnitz and Melanchthon. Right?
Oh, yeah, he was great. I mean, I loved him. And he said... one time we were sitting together having a drink, and he said, "Well, what do you really think of Agricola?" I said, B squad. He said, exactly right.
Right.
Well, he wasn't. He wasn't in the league in with Luther or Melanchthon.
No.
No, he was just, I mean, he was a second-rate guy.
Right.
And once he got an argument, you know, he pushed it to its limit, you know.
That's right. And passed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And passed, yeah.
That's exactly right.
So Luther, I mean, he does these writings. He's the great Genesis commentary comes after that. What are the last 10 years of his life? What are they consumed with?
Genesis. I mean, he started lecturing on Genesis in 1536, and he finished in 1545.
Okay.
I mean, this, the only other theologian who ever spent that much time in Genesis was Augustine. De Genesia Literum. He's
right.
After the literal sense of the text, and he just writes and writes and writes. But Luther, you know... in Luther's reading, Genesis becomes the proto-evangelion.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, you read that commentary and it's, I mean, you know, I would read it out loud to myself and weep.
Yeah, and for
just
our,
for the joy of it.
For our listeners, that's the first gospel, right? When you say
proto-evangelion,
you're talking about the first proclamation of the gospel.
Yeah.
Comes in Genesis, and we usually, when we refer to that, we're usually talking about that passage in Genesis 3,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
With the crushing of the
but
head of the serpent.
Luther's talking about the whole thing.
The whole thing. The
and
promise
especially
of Christ.
The narratives of Jacob. I mean, he understands Jacob like hardly anybody I've ever read. And he understands Jacob not in a, you know, in an abstract theological sense, but he understands him personally. And he can, I mean, he's becoming Jacob in the course of the text. And he identifies so completely with Jacob that Jacob is living. And you can hardly imagine it. I mean,
right.
where a man has become so possessed with a text that the text is interpreting him. I mean, he's lost himself in the text and he no longer knows any distinction between himself and the text. He's just... rejoicing in everything here.
You know what? I can't imagine it because I've seen you talk about, speak on Philippians and the Apostle Paul,
oh,
and I've
yeah.
seen you speak on Luther.
Well, he just, I mean.
You become these people.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. Well, it's the viva vox evangelii, the living
right.
voice of the gospel, and when the gospel gets hold of you in that way, you know, you just start to sing because the gospel is singing in you. I mean, that's what's happening in that commentary. And it's, you know, it's absolutely electric. I mean, you...
And I love to hear you say that he identifies with Jacob and he becomes Jacob, because what a character. I mean, you could say a liar and a thief, you know.
They were meant for one another.
Yeah. He's not... Jacob's not B-Squad when it comes to being a cat and a scoundrel,
no,
is he?
No, he's a real jerk.
Yeah.
I mean, you just have to love him.
And then you deal with, you know, the Jacob did I love and Esau did I hate.
Yeah.
And you say, what the heck
oh,
is
yeah.
going on
oh,
here?
Yeah.
God,
it's
God it seems like you like to confound our way of thinking about things.
Exactly right. He likes to confound thinking in the manner of Aristotle.
Yeah.
He loves sinners.
Yeah.
And Jacob qualified, boy.
Yes, he did.
This is Luther, Christ on every page.
Yeah,
on
yeah.
every page, and in the book of Genesis, the fullness of Christ abides there.
Yeah,
and you see a God who loves sinners, a
oh.
God who chooses sinners,
oh,
and a God who doesn't is a no respecter of persons.
Yeah,
and so when we encounter Scripture in that way, you are without excuse. God is good. Look at what he does. He takes pieces. Well,
you're so much without excuse. I'll describe my beloved as Jacob.
Yeah,
he's exactly. a planter.
No, exactly.
Or Abraham.
I
think
just love
Abraham
that.
Too.
No, I can remember sitting in my basement. My wife was working as an attorney, and I couldn't.
Is this in Minnesota?
In Minnesota, so
in
I
your
could,
house now or your old house?
Our old house. So we couldn't. I couldn't leave home. You know. I was the chief cook and bottle washer. She was earning us a living.
Yep.
I mean, seminary teaching, of course, is an assurance of poverty.
Yeah.
So we...
You didn't take the vows. They took you, huh?
They took you, exactly. And the dean was exacting his vengeance for imaginary sins, you know, so...
That's the imaginary sin of proclaiming the gospel.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I would sit down there in my basement and read Luther and just, I mean, I can remember sitting there thinking this is absolutely inspired. I mean,
yeah.
There's just no... Because the subject-object distance has disappeared. Luther is Jacob.
Right.
And he's singing Jacob's song, and he's singing on behalf of Jacob. And when you hear him do that, you just know he's half nuts.
Yeah. <You
know? laughs> But he's speaking. There's all these beautiful passages where he speaks in God's voice, where he speaks as God. You know, I suppose if you send him to a psychiatrist, that would be that psychiatrist would go bananas.
Well, somebody tried to do that with Luther, remember?
Yeah. Eric Erickson, yeah. He didn't get it.
Well, you know, this
he's got mommy issues.
Oh, boy. This is one of the
anal retentive.
Yeah. Oh, boy. No, it's one of the important parts of our tradition, though, as Lutherans, is this idea of how we use language to proclaim the gospel. And we forget that this is where it comes from, where we stand in the place of
that's
God
right.
and we speak to sinners and we forgive them their sins.
Boldly.
Boldly.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's a lot of fun. I love that. I just love that. And when Luther gets going that way, you just want to poke him to get more.
Yeah.
There you go.
So, Jim, as we wrap up, let's talk about Luther's last years and his death. And tomorrow we'll record another one, and I think we'll try to do the friendship between Luther and Melanchthon. But I've heard you talk a little bit about Melanchthon at Luther's funeral, and if you if you jumped into that a little bit today, I wouldn't be opposed.
Well, you know, the Luther's death was not unanticipated. Catherine von Bora was just beside herself with anxiety. There was another conflict between in the nobility over in Mansfeld, and they wanted Luther to come over. He spent a lot of his time in his last years as a mediator.
Which is interesting. You know, Bob Kolb describes Melanchthon as an ambassador for the Reformation. I think that's accurate.
I do too.
But I think it would be very accurate to say Luther is the mediator.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, you can correct me if I'm wrong, between conflicts that Melanchthon maybe started as ambassador.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
He was, you know, the difference between Luther and Melanchthon is that at one point is that Luther... knew that God was in control. Melanchthon was pretty sure he was.
Well, you know, that's funny that you say that, because one of the things I found is that Melanchthon's intense drive for doctrinal clarity very much puts him gives him the responsibility. He feels like he has the responsibility for making this as clear as possible.
And he was a genius at it. I mean, he was. There was a level of clarity that you can hardly find anyplace.
Right. But in so doing, you know, he's really at times making things, to the uninitiated especially, very unclear.
A little bit too clear.
Yeah, or a little bit too clear.
Yeah, exactly. So... Luther was called over to Mansfeld to negotiate a conflict. And there's a fabulous letter that he wrote to Katie when he was over there, going over there. She didn't want him to go. And he took one of their sons along, and he wrote a letter to Katie from Eisleben, you know.
Yep.
He said, you know, that thanks to your anxiety, I was going past the brick wall and a brick fell out of it and fell right on the wagon. If you'd worry a little bit more, I'm sure it would have killed me. So
I love his snarkiness.
Giving her a bad time. That's a lot of fun. But then, that night he had a heart attack. Again, And this time it was no fooling. I mean, it was big time. He retired to his room. And Justice Jonas was with him.
Right. His pastor.
His pastor. And, you know, tried to help him as much as possible, but his heart had really exploded.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, that was everything but the last minute. And so he retired to his room and he was resting there. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he had another heart attack, and this one was lethal. So he had written in the meantime on the pad on the desk, "Wir sind Petler, hoc est verum." Mm. Combination of Latin and German.
Right.
"We are beggars, this is the truth."
That's right.
And that was the last written word that there was. And this is out of 126 volumes of writing. There's just this one phrase, "Wir sind Petler, hoc est verum." I'm a beggar, we are beggars, this is the truth. And Jonas was with him to the very end as his pastor.
And friend.
And friend and confessor. And
yeah. Famous translator of Luther and Melanchthon.
Yeah, just magnificent.
Yeah.
He was great.
Underestimated character in the
Luther Reformation. He is great. Justus Jonas, you know, you can't imagine. So that was the end of him, and I mean, the funeral lasted for about 5 days. I mean, they were hauling him back on the wagon, you know, to Wittenberg. They were sorry that he died over there, and they wanted him back, and so they made arrangements for him to be brought back to Wittenberg to be buried, and he's buried now in the castle church in Wittenberg. So you can go in there and see his tomb.
Melanchthon too.
Sure. They're buried side by side in that floor.
Yeah.
It's really great, boy.
Yeah.
I love that place.
Well, we're going to cap this episode off there. Tomorrow, I hope we find some more time again. I'd really love to do Luther and Melanchthon, the friendship.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know as much about that as I do.
Well, I don't know about that. But I think the thing that's fun is that I think you're right. You know, Luther had some deep suspicions of Melanchthon, but he regarded him as a friend.
He interpreted him in the kindest light.
Right. He interpreted him in the light that he tells us to in his explanation of the Eighth Commandment.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly true.
To put the best construction on everything.
He does exactly that.
Hey, we've all had that friend that drags us into the trouble that we weren't looking for.
Yeah.
I've often been that guy for a lot of people.
I know you have.
There we go.
But I think it's the thing that's funny, and it's not funny, that I appreciate, is that of all of our, as we can look on it in retrospect with Melanchthon especially and be critical, Luther never criticized him publicly, not once.
No, he loved him.
He loved him.
Yep.
And so we'll talk about that hopefully tomorrow. We'll find some time.
Yep.
But And when we do that, I'd really love you to do the Melanchthon at Erasmus at Luther's funeral.
Yeah, that was awful.
Yeah.
No, I don't like to talk about that, but I will.
I know, but it'll be fun. All right, Jim, thank you.
Yeah, God
Kevin,
bless.
Kevin, thank you. I'm going to bring you in tomorrow if you're
thank
around.
You. Of course.
I need a co-host. All right, this is Thinking Fellows. Thank you for listening, and we appreciate your support.